listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with local author Bill Schubart, whose latest novel is Panhead, A Journey Home. Bill Schubart has lived with his family in Vermont since 1947. He writes about Vermont in fiction, humor, and opinion pieces. He is also a founder of Resolution, Inc., a co-founder of Philo Records, and founder of the Pleiades Music Group. At the age of 26, Bill Schubart was elected chairman of the Board of Trustees for the Vermont Arts Council, the state's arts agency. He was the youngest trustee ever to serve as chairman, and then he served again at the age of 41. At 30, he joined the board of the Vermont Symphony Orchestra. In 1984, he became chairman of the Vermont Folklife Center. At the request of then-Governor Madeline Cunin, Bill Schubart chaired the Vermont Statehood Bicentennial Commission, planning the celebration for Vermont's 200th birthday in 1991. He has chaired the Arts Council's Media Panel, Literature Panel, and Visual Arts Panel, and has served as a resource panelist for the National Endowment of the Arts. In addition, he has advised many nonprofit and educational organizations on a variety of cultural and technical projects, including the formation of Vermont Public Radio, on whose board he recently served as chair. Additionally, he has taught courses at the University of Vermont in music, technology, and business. Bill Schubart writes and speaks extensively on the media and other civic issues. He has spoken at numerous industry and media events, including Book Expo. He is a regular commentator on Vermont Public Radio. His interests include poetry, photography, stone gardening, food preparation, classical and primitive music. He lives in Hinesburg with his wife, Catherine, also a writer. And he has three sons, Bill, Peter, and Stephen, and a daughter, Anna, as well as a stepson, Guy, and stepdaughter, Phoebe. His previous books are The Lamoille Stories and Fat People, a collection of stories about which I interviewed him in 2011. In 2012, just last week, I interviewed him at the Fletcher Free Library. We spoke about his new novel, Panhead, A Journey Home, and I began by asking him to read an excerpt from the book.
1972. Paul and Glenda enjoy swimming more than any of their other pastimes. The fields of the Lefebvre farm lie among several forest ponds, though they only swim in Long Pond, a boggy forest pond with endless marshes and an impenetrable alder thicket at the south end. Negro Pond, quietly renamed after the war, lies deeper in the woods, but is too shallow for swimming. It's also rife with bloodsuckers, as it is too shallow to support the bass that feed on them in the depths of Long Pond. Paul and Glenda are walking through the woods towards Long Pond. The forest floor is carpeted with maidenhair ferns. A barely visible path winds through the ferns down to the one spot along the shore that is suitable for swimming. Here the water is deep enough so their kicking feet don't touch the murky bottom as they paddle around in the cool water. They're powerful swimmers, and their mother doesn't pause when they tell her they're going off for a swim, though she's very strict about her admonition not to swim for one full hour after a meal to avoid cramps. Her abiding fear is of the lake below and between the mountains. The deepest lake in New England, Willoughby, is legendary for swallowing swimmers, boaters, and fishermen when sudden winds come up between the mountains. From its depth, Esther infers that if something should ever happen to her children swimming or canoeing there, their bodies would never be recovered for burial, and she imagines this would be even worse than losing a child. Paul and Glenda are happiest in the water. They swim side by side out into the middle of the pond. Paul occasionally likes to dive straight down and see if he can touch bottom. The pond is rarely deeper than 20 feet, and often he breaks the surface with a handful of muck in his right hand that he holds aloft and yells to Glenda, "See, I did it." The less Glenda knows about what lies at the bottom of the pond, the more enjoyable is her time in it. But she's always encouraged Paul's exploits. Paul prefers to dive off the end of an exposed ledge sloping gently into the pellucid water. He must get a running start to miss the rock shelf a few feet below the surface. The water looks like tea brewed from the underbrush and leaves that steepen it. Treading the cool water patiently, Paul watches from afar as Glenda carefully removes her jeans and cotton shirt and lays them out on the sunlit rock so they'll be warm when she emerges. She's now in her cotton underpants, and she sits down on the rough granite with its flecks of reindeer moss and lichens. And using her hands, she lifts her fanny off the rock and scuttles slowly down the rock face until her feet are in the water. Paul is aware that his sister is taking on the characteristics of a woman. He notices for the first time as she leans forward on the rock, her incipient breasts and the curves emerging from her boyish frame. She takes her time joining Paul, who is paddling about and whooping at a heron on the other side of the pond. Finally, with a gasp, Glenda slides in and breaststrokes towards Paul. As she nears him, he looks away from the great blue heron lifting slowly off the pond with its feet folded back towards its tail, and he rotates in the water toward Glenda. He's calmed by the image of her swimming toward him. It's as if he's seeing her for the first time. Her faintly reddish hair lies flat against her forehead, and farther down trails in the wake behind her neck. The few pale freckles on her forehead are made more evident by the brilliant sun. Her blue eyes reflect the water, and with each breaststroke, her lips open and take in air that she exhales and some pond water that she spurts out between her pursed lips. Her strong arms complete their sweep behind her and come together under her and forward for another powerful breaststroke. Then she's at his side. He notices that now he must work harder treading water to stay afloat than she does. Water beads on her forehead and cheeks, and the soft space between her nostrils and upper lip. He notices the clarity of her pale skin. He's never seen her in this light. She knows he is seeing something for the first time and says only, "Go ahead, kiss me. It's all right." He does so quickly, his hands still treading water. She smiles at Paul's embarrassment. "You're good," she says. And he asks, "How do you know?" "I know," she answers and laughs. Paul splashes water in her face and dives down to the bottom. When he surfaces, she's still there, lightly treading water, her hair fanned out around her neck. Paul looks at her and knows their life together has changed and that it will be different from then on.
Thanks very much for reading that. That's Bill Schubart reading from Panhead, A Journey Home. So that section of the book is one of many recollected memories. And Paul is actually at a different point in his life, and he's in the hospital remembering his life. So I wonder if you can talk a little bit about why he's in the hospital and how you came to have the idea for Panhead.
It's funny, when I think about why I wrote Panhead, it almost felt, and of course one really only understands this in retrospect, that it was sort of an expression of the sum of all my fears.
Huh.
I've always had both a great love of water and being in water, and also fear. And of course, Lake Willoughby, which we spend a lot of time on as kids, is a very sort of dark and mysterious lake, very, very deep. And we swam in it as kids, and it was always great fun, but every once in a while that "what's down there" thing would, especially when we were swimming across the lake.
Right.
So that was a big piece of it. Another fear I've had, and again, it's more accurate to say it's a fascination with and a fear of water. The other one, which plays very strongly in the book, is motorcycles. I've had motorcycles for most of my life, and at age 67 have a chopper, which I love to ride and am also very scared of. Uh-huh. And the book is called Panhead, and it's a very sort of arcane title, and there's no rhyme nor reason for the average person as to what that would mean. But Harley Davidson in their classic days, made three engines, the panhead, the shovelhead, and the knucklehead. And the motorcycle that plays very importantly in the book was a 1949 panhead, which I owned. The book is, the architecture of the book is somewhat unusual because the very beginning of the book is defined in a massive motorcycle accident. And I'm not spoiling it for anybody because it's in the first couple of pages. And the chapters alternate between what happens right after the accident and flashback to the main character's childhood. And those keep alternating all the way through. So that's, you know, without giving away the very end, that's sort of an overview of the novel. It brings the main character from his very early childhood with his sister right on up through adulthood. And I think a persistent theme in it is the theme of boys in school. And I remember, again, this was one of those love-fear things in my own life, is I grew up and went to school in Morrisville, Vermont, public schools, and learned a lot and then went away to school in New Hampshire. And all of a sudden, all of the success that I thought I had felt as a young child was in huge jeopardy because there were much, much greater demands. And I began to realize that I was drifting away very often from what was happening in the classroom. And now, in retrospect, at the age of 67, having known a lot of boys and having had sons for whom this was a real experience too, that the culture of the classroom in the very early days was very feminine, and girls did really well and boys often would drift away in the classroom, and that's a major theme in the novel, the relationship between the lead character and his sister, where she goes off to McGill and does extremely well and always has done well. And he works and works and works and struggles to do well. And then it's assumed that he's going to go to college. And he does, but it's overwhelming. And it goes to the issue that's very prevalent today about the incredible number of boys who fail in the public school systems, and why that happens.
Okay. How about when you were a kid? Was it hard for you? Was school hard for you, or was it pretty
easy
for you?
Certain things were. I remember doing well in the primary grades, but I remember my parents having to ask for an exemption for script writing. Because I couldn't do it. I could only do block letters. And that was a real source of trauma to me.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
I'd watch the other kids do it, and I couldn't do the beautiful script that they did.
How about now?
I still can't. When I write, I still, my signature is just kind of a
no. You're right. It's
sloppy flourish, but if I'm taking notes or anything, it's all block letters.
All print.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So you've mentioned a couple times now your age.
Yes.
And I'm wondering, there is a theme in this book because of the motorcycle accident. There's a theme of mortality. Do you feel like maybe you're starting to think about that more than you used to?
I'm sure of it. I mean, one of the things that is really dominant in my life at this age is I've always just routinely, and this is very much, I think, a factor of growing up in a small town, and my stepfather, who was a wonderful man, who could never say no to anybody. And I have inherited that.
Mm-hmm.
But as I get older and the time gets more precious, I realize I've got to circle the wagons and say no, whether it's civic things or, you know, whatever, so that I can finish what I love doing, which is writing. I mean, I literally have three books planned and ready to go in my head. In fact, I've written the novel that I'm working on now, which I've been working on for 7 years, will be ready this fall, and the next novel is already written.
Wow.
In first draft form.
Okay.
So,
your previous books have had some autobiographical content, so I'm
yes.
wondering the extent to which Panhead has, not that you have to get very specific, but is a lot of this drawn from your life?
I would say very much so, but like most fiction writers, I'm a fabulist.
Yeah.
So I sort of create metaphorical landscapes and so on, but the emotional content is I think, very autobiographical.
Okay.
A lot of the stuff around water and friends growing up on hill farms and farms being auctioned off and,
yeah.
you know, kids being hurt in tractor accidents, that's very, very much so.
Yeah. How about,
and frankly, the college experience is too.
This too. Did you work in construction?
I did.
Yeah, that sounded
I did. I worked in Red Bank, New Jersey. For a company that would go into a cornfield. It's very similar to this. They'd go into a cornfield, and 6 weeks later, there'd be finished houses here and cellar holes here.
Yeah.
Go in and, you know, build 120 homes.
Wow. That's funny. So as you've mentioned, the book is a series of juxtapositions back and forth mm-hmm. in Paul's consciousness in the hospital and his memories of life. Before the accident. So can you talk about deciding on this structure? Did you ever play around with doing, you know, bigger chunks of his life interspersed
yeah.
differently or anything?
Honestly, no. I mean, I described the accident, and then I described the ambulance
yep.
Section, and then I flashed back to his childhood. And then for some reason I felt compelled to go back to what was happening in the ambulance. And I have to honestly say I hadn't thought it out carefully or anything. It just sort of all of a sudden started going back and forth.
And that was interesting because I would find myself looking forward to knowing, okay, so here we are in, let's you know, Lake Willoughby, and mm-hmm. I want to know what's happening in the hospital. And then we'd be back in the hospital, and I'm like, okay, so what's going to happen next, mm-hmm. you know, back in his childhood, which was
well,
kind of...
If I had planned it out and thought about it, I would have felt that it was a great risk. But it just seemed to keep coming. I don't know. I'll tell you one interesting thing was I was writing all this stuff in the hospital. And then I thought to myself, boy, do you really know what you're talking about? So I called a friend of mine at Fletcher Allen and asked for the name of a trauma surgeon. And I was given the name of a really terrific guy who's also a poet.
Uh-huh.
And I said, I need you to do a verisimilitude check on this. And
Can we know his name?
Absolutely. He was really a very terrific guy. And the wonderful thing about him, his name is Paige Hudson.
Okay.
And the wonderful thing about him was that not only did he make corrections on the anatomical side, he had literary comments that were germane and interesting.
Oh, great. That's
so
cool, because he's a poet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One of the things that he pointed out is I had talked about a cracked pelvis.
Uh-huh.
And he looked at me and he said, quite frankly, Bill, he said, the cracked pelvises, they never make it into the emergency room. They bleed out on the highway.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So it was, he had a lot of very good suggestions.
Yeah, yeah.
And the other thing that he said, which I had not occurred to me, is I talk about what's going on in the ambulance when they're taking him in. And the question was, you know, did they have radio contact in ambulances at that time?
Mm.
And he called his father,
oh,
who's
wow.
an old retired trauma surgeon, and said, look, on this date, did they have? And his father said, yes. Primitive, but yes.
Okay. So that's good to know.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, why did you choose to tell Paul's story in the present tense?
It's a really tough question, and I'm facing the same thing in the book that I'm writing now, which is much longer. there's something to me that's remarkably present about the present tense, and that propels the reader. It just feels more intimate. Mm-hmm. And I have to be terribly careful because the natural thing is to write in the past.
Right.
And I literally have to go through very carefully everything I've written when it's in the present tense and correct all the places where I've automatically lapsed into, you know, a past tense.
Uh-huh.
And I have to be careful about the imperfect, the pluperfect, you know, and
right.
Because subconsciously I want to write in the past. So it requires a lot of attention, and the editor that I work with is a really wonderful person. Seems to feel very comfortable with it.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, and I think it's really, it's a style of preference and choice for a lot of projects.
And
yeah.
And in the book I'm writing now, the actual choice of tense becomes very important because there's intense description of photography, and that's always in the present, so that the reader feels that they're looking at a photograph.
Uh-huh.
Anyway.
Yeah. So I don't actually have a question here, but I do love some of the characters who show up and then duck back out of the book. One of them is Uncle Theron,
mm-hmm.
right? And I wondered if you had an uncle like that.
I did. I mean, I combined two people into Uncle Theron.
Okay.
Just highly eccentric, very, very connected to the land, very comfortable being alone, and eccentric.
Yeah.
And as I say, the two people I'm thinking of, I just melded into one.
Right.
But yes.
And Tommy. And I loved that we learned about Tommy's family situation. His family farm is foreclosed on, and they're in some serious financial trouble.
Yeah.
And then we learned more about Tommy, the personal life of Tommy as he becomes an adult. And I already had such empathy for him because of what he'd gone through as a child, losing his home. Not to give too much away, but I really loved his character. And mm-hmm. even though he shows up more intensely as a child and we hear more about him as an adult, I just was very invested in his storyline.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting you say that because that actually is the one character I didn't know.
Mm.
And it always intrigued me that I took him to that place sexually because, you know, growing up in very much that circumstance, there was no discussion of homosexuality.
Mm-hmm.
And if anybody had any incipient feelings about it, they were, you know. And so I was a little bit worried as to whether it would work.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, it was certainly there. It was like, you know, you talk to somebody in a small town like Morrisville, Vermont, or wherever, and there were no alcoholics, and there was no sexual abuse, and there was no violence, and there was no nothing.
Right.
Ever.
Right.
You know,
a perfect town.
Perfect town.
Okay. At one, and then Mrs. Benton. I loved Mrs. Benton, who's
uh-huh.
the owner of the bed and breakfast where Paul stays at a certain point in his life. And at one point in a scene at Mrs. Benton's bed and breakfast, you mention the books that are lying in one of her rooms. You cite Cry the Beloved Country, Return to Paradise, The Kane Mutiny, The Cruel Sea, other books.
Mm-hmm.
So why these? Why did you pick these?
I picked those because they were popular at the time, and
uh-huh.
they were all digested in the Reader's Digest. Do you remember that series, the condensed books?
Yeah.
And Mrs. Benton's dead husband would have those books.
Right.
Because he would be a Reader's Digest person.
Yes.
And
oh, so these were Reader's Digest condensed books that you mentioned?
Yes.
I missed that completely.
Yeah, I think it may be subtle in there, but
okay.
I'm pretty sure it's in there.
I missed that. Okay.
Yeah.
No,
and I put in, and they were all books that were condensed by Reader's Digest.
Yeah, whatever happened to those? My parents had those books, and now I never see those.
When I went through any library that I've ever been through, home library, I've thrown them out. just out of like anticipating the concept.
Yeah. Like spark notes. Or
but I did put in my editor's father's book, The Snow Leopard.
Oh, okay.
Which was one of their condensed books.
All right, interesting. May I read a paragraph from the book?
Sure.
Okay. 1975. In another aborted discussion about college, Paul has openly defied his father. He's walking on the road away from home. It is winter. At 17, he has never openly challenged or even questioned his father's judgment. A waxing moon bathes the landscape in an opalescent light. A few dark clouds hover in the sky around the moon and just above the mountainous horizon. There is no wind. The day's earlier snow still drapes the hemlocks. Their normally upright branches pulled down by the snow into the snowdrifts at their base. A few of the lowest branches have broken from the weight of the snow. That paragraph just stood out to me as such a beautiful way to show where he's at emotionally in that moment. He's had an argument with his father, and the writing so beautifully reflects what's happening. You know, it's like he's had this argument and he needs to get out of that mode, and he loses himself in the natural world for a moment, which I'm sure is what any young man living in Vermont in the in the countryside would want to do. It's also just a beautifully written paragraph. So
well, thank you.
I loved it. I also was just wondering, do you, when you're writing about the out of doors, do you go outside and take a lot of notes to remind yourself of the beautiful things that you want to recount, or do you just have that much memory from living here all your life that it comes out at the computer?
It's all memory.
It's all there.
I'm writing in a third floor, you know, at 5 o'clock in the morning. And my next book is called Photographic Memory.
Oh, okay.
And I have just, I don't know what it is, but I have intense images in my head from my childhood and, you know, from being outdoors.
Mm-hmm. All right.
And I still spend a lot of time outdoors. And if I'm cutting wood outside and see something unusual, I may write it as, you know, current rather than mnemonic.
Yeah. Okay, great. So you did work in construction, and you have owned motorcycles, and you lived in Vermont all your life, so you have all of this knowledge. What did you have to research, if anything, for this book? Was there anything that you were writing about that you really needed to know more about before you could put the words on the page?
It was really the medical.
Yep.
The rest of it was pretty much memory. I had to do a little bit of research on the motorcycle that he's riding with, that his roommate is riding with, the Vincent Black Shadow.
Yeah, okay.
Which is an extremely, and my college roommate had a Vincent Black Shadow.
Okay. Was your college roommate Danny, or did you invent Danny and give him the same motorcycle?
It was Danny.
It was Danny.
Yeah.
Interesting. Wow. Do we have any worries Danny's going to read the book?
Danny is dead.
Oh, okay.
Yes, I checked that out.
I should not be laughing at poor Danny's demise.
No. It's actually funny because the first book, the Lamoille stories, I was terrified when the book came out, and I quickly reread it because I hadn't done a very good job masking names.
No.
At all. And I would do things like, you know, there'd be a character who I knew very well as a kid named Max Trepanier. And the name Trepanier was so compelling and wonderful that I'd leave that and change it to, like, Alfred Trepanier. So then all of a sudden the book is extremely popular in Lamoille County.
Of course it is.
And I go over there. I go over there, and the crowd is too big for the library, so they move it to the church. And I'm sitting there in a complete panic, looking out at the sea of somewhat familiar faces. And this very heavy woman gets to her feet, and she looks at me, and she says, "Billy Couture, I know every damn person in that book." And I went by the name Couture when I was young, because I grew up in a French-Canadian family. And at that point, like, the blood just stopped moving in my body. So...
But nobody sued you.
No.
That's good.
In fact, the people who did recognize themselves who were still alive seemed rather proud to be part of it.
All right. This book takes place mostly in the 1960s and 70s. And it's a very intense time in the country politically, and yet you make the choice not to really go there. I was wondering if you thought about it, and if you, you know, why? Why did you make the choice not to go there?
I think because it is, it was reflective of my lack of political sensibility myself at that period.
Oh, okay.
I really didn't become more politically attuned until after that period. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was catatonic with, you know, what happened at Kent State and, you know, the Vietnam War. And but it would have felt like a distraction and an ill-informed distraction for that character.
Right. Okay. Because you are very politically savvy now, and you are a commentator on VPR, for example, and so that's interesting. I love the cover of the book. I kind of hate talking about covers on the radio because nobody can look at it, but if people go online, they'll be able to see it. It's a great cover. It's a close-up photograph of a boy's face. He's swimming, probably in a Vermont swimming hole or Lake Willoughby or something, and he looks very cold and maybe a little bit sad, or maybe just too cold, I don't know. And there's a girl swimming off to the side behind him. It's a cover. Even if I didn't know that we were going to have this conversation, I totally would have picked this book off the shelf because of the cover. So I'm wondering if you can talk about the design.
Well, it's wonderful to hear that because a friend of mine who used to be CFO of Random House and very, very deeply connected to everything in publishing.
Okay.
I sent him the design. It's a New York designer who's wonderful. She mostly works with major dance companies, but she's done books.
Uh-huh.
And we went back and forth, and she showed me a lot of things. This is a amateur photograph that came off the web that she found, and I contacted the photographer and paid her, you know, for the rights to use it. And I showed it to this friend of mine, and he said, "Forget about it. It's terrible. It's horrible. Who would ever buy a book with that cover?"
No way.
I know. And he said, come on, now log on to Amazon. He said, okay, look at the 10 best fiction sellers. Do you see anything like that? And I said, no. And I saw all this sort of hyper design, you know, that wasn't telling me too much about what was in the book.
The 10 New York Times bestsellers, you've already heard of before you ever see the cover, so
yeah,
it's irrelevant.
I know.
Says me.
No, it's true. And I mean, it goes to the much, much larger issue, which is a show in itself about, you know, how the whole world of publishing and, and books is changing.
Yeah. So who's the photographer?
Aaron Weikenthal from Ottawa.
Okay. And Alex Ching designed.
Alex Ching is the designer. She's a wonderful designer.
Okay. All right. Great. So you mentioned that you write in the third floor of your house. What's your schedule like? When do you write?
I write as soon as I... The difficulty for me is that I wake up writing. And there will be things going through my head, and I think I'm awake, but I'm sort of asleep. And then all of a sudden I am awake, and this whole scene is unfolded. And I'm anxious to write it, and I've been infused with some adrenaline. So I make a pot of tea and go upstairs and write.
Mm-hmm. Is that at 5 in the morning or at noon?
It's any time from 4:30 till 5:30 in the morning.
Wow.
I'm almost always upstairs by 5 o'clock.
Wow. Okay.
And it's wonderful. It's quiet. The phone never rings. The email's off, and I can get into it. The one thing that I have found that is bizarre is I can't multitask. When I'm writing, I'm writing. But there are certain books that I will be listening to non-vocal music very, very low, just barely audible. And once that starts when I'm writing a book, I'm playing that music over and over and over again. And it somehow becomes the fabric or a part of the fabric of the book.
Mm.
It was really the case in the book that I have finished, but is two books away from a release. It's a book called I Am Baby, and it is about a blind street singer that I knew and actually recorded an album of in New York, and it's first person. to writing a first-person novel about a blind woman.
Wow.
But there's a single piece of music that is haunting all the way through it. And now I can't do anything in the book without that being just barely audible.
Wow.
It's an odd thing.
Yeah. Yeah, you have to pick the music carefully so you don't end up listening to something that you despise by the end of the year.
Yeah, no, I know. It's almost all Estonian music.
Okay.
Which is why, don't ask me.
Do you go to writing conferences?
I don't.
No?
No. I'm on the board of the Vermont College of Fine Arts, which is really a fascinating place and experience. I don't.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not, that's not fair to say. I've been to one or two and not particularly found them very compelling.
Generative or helpful.
No. What's helpful to me is to talk to an individual writer,
uh-huh.
you know, uh-huh. about their experience. But it's also personal.
Yeah, right. Do you get feedback from, you mentioned editors, but do you get feedback from other people before you publish?
My process is I write a first draft. And then I do anywhere from 5 to 7 edits, which takes months. And then I send it out to 3 critical readers who owe me nothing and hopefully don't know me, which is the case more often than not. And then when it comes back...
How do you find those people who don't know you?
I ask people who I know who... And you pay them.
Uh-huh.
You pay a critical reader. So
okay.
There are people who just do that.
Okay.
And it's better to pay them because...
Then you'll get an honest reaction.
Yeah, they owe you nothing.
Yeah.
You know, they owe you an honest reaction. And if that's all good, then I send it to my editor for the first time, who's Hope Matheson, Peter Matheson's daughter, who's really wonderful, and she reads it, does no copy editing, nothing about grammar, you know. She'll pick up plot anomalies, but she'll basically give me 30,000-foot feedback. It's really helpful. And then I go back and make whatever changes I'm going to make there, and then it goes to the copy editor, and then it goes to the designer.
So. Okay. All right. Great. You published through Magic Hill Publishing, which is your imprint.
Yes. My first book was with a small publisher who did everything they said they would do. But I didn't make very much money, and it's sold and still sells extremely well. So I just decided, you know, it's easier if I own the publishing company.
Uh-huh.
So I set it up directly with Ingram, and... You know, instead of getting $1.40 a book, I get anywhere from $3 to $6 a book.
Okay.
You know, which is much nicer.
So, for the general public, somebody who, you know, wants to get their book published, do you recommend self-publishing or do you not?
It really depends. I mean, it depends on what the writer needs and wants. I've talked to some writers who, more than anything, want the literary imprimatur of a recognized publisher.
Mm-hmm.
And if that's what you want, then you just got to fight for that, whether you get it or not. But publishing has changed so much. The sort of implied censure of vanity publishing
mm-hmm.
is gone.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a good and a bad thing. I mean, a lot of very well-known writers are leaving their publishing companies and publishing on their own because the major barriers of entry are gone. And a lot of very good writers who have been with major publishers, you know, sold 5, 6, 7, 8,000 copies, which is really credible. But ended up in the middle list, and so there was their next book wasn't picked up, and their first book is in limbo. And other than filling the pipeline once, publishers don't do a whole lot anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they don't send you on a book tour, and they don't take out a lot of display advertising, which doesn't do much good. So a lot of writers who are willing to have figured I can do what a publisher would do to some degree myself.
Mm-hmm.
But again, the flux is so great right now, it's really hard to tell where it's going to settle out. I just focus primarily on filling the Vermont pipeline and getting what national reviews I can and hope for the best. And it's been pretty good, actually.
What steps do you take to undertake, let's say, a Vermont tour? What do you do?
I have a database that's absolutely up to date of every Vermont bookstore, all the contact information. I let them know. I don't spam them. I let them know when a book is coming out. I let them know when the book's out, ask them if they want a store copy, and tell them how they can get it. Make it very simple, ordering from Ingram. I try and send out links to my own list that enable people to buy an ebook through their independent bookstore. And that's going away. Google has dropped that program. Mm. So,
do you manage all this yourself, or does someone help you?
No, I do it. It's a lot of work. I mean, for an awful lot of writers, they don't want to do all that work.
Right.
They want to write books.
Okay, so we talked a little bit about the title of the book, Panhead, A Journey Home. But I wanted to know how you decided on that title and subtitle, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And did you go through a long process of picking several different things, or was that it?
I just called it Panhead. And the difficulty is you know, people, is it Panhead or Pinhead? And what is Panhead? You know, I mean, it's a very non-illustrative title.
Okay.
I'm not sure that I would have done it again. And then, of course, it was so non-illustrative that I added A Journey Home. And, you know, it is what it is.
When I saw the book cover, and, of course, I saw the cover and read the title at the same time. Not of course, but anyway, that's how it happened for me. So I thought, that's this poor kid's nickname.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
So I just, because I don't know anything about motorcycles.
Yeah, no, and
it's better than 99%
of the people, even people who do know about motorcycles, don't know what a pinhead is.
Okay. Well, so I was going to ask you as advice for writers who are trying to come up with titles, but do you have any advice for writers who are trying to title their books?
The titles usually emerge for me before, you know, back at the earliest planning stage of the book. The book I'm working on now, the title was the first thing that came up in my head. The same thing for the first draft that I finished. So it's not something I've spent a lot of time over. In the book Fat People, it's so blunt and so in your face. I mean, it's like the vagina monologues.
Right.
You know, it's just, it's sort of a hit. But it's also honest,
mm-hmm.
which the book tries hard to be.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, great. Well, listen, Bill Shubart, thank you so much for speaking with me today. The book is Panhead, A Journey Home. How can people find the book? What's your website, or what's the best spot?
It depends on whether they want a hard copy. It's in pretty much every bookstore in Vermont.
Okay.
And if they don't have it, they can order it from Ingram. But most of the stores that I'm aware of are carrying it and doing fairly well with it. If they want the ebook, they can go to either Barnes & Noble, Apple, Google Play, or Kindle on Amazon.
Or
Kindle. Yeah.
Okay.
It's available in all four formats.
Okay. So, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Bill Shubart. You can learn more about his work at his website, shubart.com. Today's Write the Book prompt was inspired by my interview with Bill Shubart about his new book, just out, Panhead, A Journey Home. Write about an accident. It can be something real from your life, or it can be a fictional incident. Maybe your sister threw her croquet mallet in a huff when you were small and hit you with it. Or maybe it was something more serious, like a boating accident or a burn from a spill. If it was an actual incident, write a poem or a story or an essay about how this incident changed one of the people involved. Or if it is fictional, imagine how it might have changed someone and write about that. Good luck with this prompt, and tune in next week for another. Write the Book has a Facebook page. If you're a Facebook user, please go to the Write the Book Radio Show Facebook page and like us. If you're interested in sharing the show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. If you have comments about the show, news about book-related events, if you want to suggest a writing prompt, or if you'd like to suggest an author for me to get in touch with, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. I have had a few people ask me to get in touch with some of their favorite authors, and those are in the works. If you're one of the people that's contacted me about interviewing somebody that you're interested to hear about, do know that those are in the works. Please remember that this station is here thanks to community support and involvement. More information about The Radiator is available online at theradiator.org. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont.